The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, we made it through a major, major snowstorm here in the Midlands of the UK. 6 to 8 inches of snow just yesterday, all around Edstone, in fact. And it's gaining quite a lot of attention, even internationally, as far as the news coverage goes. But for us here locally, we're all in good shape, a little bit chilly. It's just now starting to warm up. Actually, today it's supposed to be still pretty cold, but at least the sun's coming out, and we're starting to see at least a little bit of the snow melt. But we sure enjoyed it yesterday here on campus. Had a few snowball fights, some big snowmen that were built up on the back lawn, and down by the soccer field too. There's a nice little steep slope. It's not for, doesn't go on for very long, but we were able to do some sledding, a bunch of us, last night, just as the sun was setting, as well. So it's been a fun, chilly weekend, and just beautiful, gorgeous setting here at Edstone. I thought I also would mention that Richard Palmer told me Friday, I believe, was our best traffic or our highest traffic day at the website since Brexit a year and a half ago. I guess one of our articles was linked on a popular site, so that helped to bring a lot of people to thetrumpet.com. And of course, as you know, there's lots and lots of material on the website daily, whether it's the written word or videos or these radio podcasts as well, and we're continuing to churn out as much material as we can, particularly with so much going on in the world today. On today's program here, I'm going to update you a little bit on the tentative agreement on the Brexit negotiations. I guess that came through late Friday night after the news cycle had ended for the week. So there's quite a lot that commentators have had to say over the last couple of days about these ongoing Brexit negotiations. So we've got a couple of pieces from the Telegraph and I think another source that bring out some details on that. Also, there's more to pass along to you regarding the governmental crisis in Germany. That, as we know, is really a critical story to watch, and one story in particular. I know others have made comparisons to the Weimar Republic, what's happening in Germany today as compared to what happened in the 1920s and in particular in the early 1930s. So we'll look at that. I think one commentator in particular had some really excellent points to make regarding that parallel. Later on in the show, we'll look into the first commandment, what it means to put God first in all that you say and do. Well, yesterday, the Sunday edition of the New York Times ran a front page feature about Donald Trump's hour-by-hour battle for self-preservation, as the Times put it. Three journalists contributed to this story, including one who was recently fired for sexual misconduct. But it's a 4,300-word profile that details the president's love for cable news television shows, his love for conspiracy theories. It tells us how much he loves Diet Coke. I guess he drinks quite a few of those every single day. He also loves dessert, we learn in this 4,300-word feature. Massive slices of pie and cake, together with an extra helping of ice cream on top. He's not real big on books or briefings, the Times says, because he's a man with the attention span of a jackrabbit. That's a direct quote. So he prefers the verbal meetings. And, of course, hours and hours of cable news television, sometimes 4 hours a day, sometimes twice that, the New York Times says. He does still read newspapers, marking them up with a Sharpie pen. But for the most part, you walk away from that feature thinking, wow, here is someone who's immersed into television. That the White House is basically run like a reality show. That was in the New York Times. The Telegraph here in the UK picked it up and had this to say this morning. Donald Trump told aides to treat each presidential day like a TV drama in which he vanquishes rivals by the end of each episode, according to former and current officials interviewed for a new profile. The Telegraph says the result is an hour-by-hour fight with critics as he relitigates last year's election or fends off investigators, picking through his inner circle for evidence of collusion with Russian officials. And so this feature, going back to the New York Times, of course it mentions all of his Twitter habits and how that a lot of those tweets spring from the morning news shows that he watches religiously. This particular hit piece, and that's essentially what it is, but it made me think of another New York Times feature from about 4 years ago. President Obama's television habits. This is from December of 2013. And back then, the Times says, by his own accounts, Mr. Obama is drawn in his spare time to shows like HBO's Game of Thrones and Boardwalk Empire, the kind of heavy, darkly rendered television that echoes the sadness and strife that make up so much of his workday. So he likes to watch the more edgy shows, the Times said about President Obama, shows that kind of echo the sadness and the strife that he has to face up to day in and day out as president of the United States. Those days, or rather it says these days when Mr. Obama retreats to the White House residence after a long day, he puts in long days, keep in mind, long days at work, and when he does finally retreat to the residence, then it's not uncommon for him to watch these shows, Game of Thrones, Boardwalk Empire, I'm not familiar with most of these, Breaking Bad, that's an award-winning show, evidently. It says further on, friends say Mr. Obama is also keenly awaiting the new season of the Netflix show House of Cards, which starkly depicts a dysfunctional Washington, a theme that must seem all too familiar. Here again, he's watching programs with themes that he's very familiar with. He was a big fan, we know, and according to one article I saw this morning, again, this was from a few years ago, he typically, toward the end of the year, in a more, a more casual interview, he would typically inform America of the shows he was watching. He was a big fan of Homeland, of Mad Men, The Wire. He called The Wire one of the greatest shows of all time. And again, I'm not familiar with that particular program. In 2015, President Obama said Cinemax's The Nick was his favorite show of the year. From the Los Angeles Times that year, it says, the commander-in-chief clearly prides himself on keeping current with TV's prestige dramas. Back in 2012, he was obsessed with Homeland, just like the rest of the country. In an interview for GQ, Obama told Bill Simmons he is an avid fan of the violent series The Game of Thrones. And, of course, Mr. Obama was well known to be a lover of sports on television. He loved ESPN Sports Center. He went on Sports Center each March, I think it was, to pick his winners for March Madness. He also told TV Guide one time that he and his family loved to watch Modern Family, the ABC sitcom Parks and Recreation. But I thought this was interesting, going back to that 2013 New York Times piece. It said, it may be a fool's errand to psychoanalyze anyone, let alone a sitting president, based only on the books he reads or the music he listens to or the television shows he watches. You know, we don't want to overstate the importance of this. And we certainly can't really psychoanalyze anyone based upon their viewing habits. That was 4 years ago. And of course, the feature yesterday, they pretty well psychoanalyzed the sitting president, the current president, based upon his viewing habits. His love, this is going back to 2013. Speaking of Obama's love for Game of Thrones, Boardwalk Empire, all these shows I mentioned a moment ago. He says, it could be that they're the kind of heavy, darkly rendered television that echoes the sadness and strife that make up so much of his workday. I mentioned part of that quote just a moment ago, but then it leads into this. Perhaps that is what television is for Mr. Obama, a poetic reflection. Or maybe despite his day job, the president simply enjoys the cliffhanger tensions of the best dramas. So that's the way the New York Times talked about the TV habits of the previous president as compared to the one it wrote about yesterday. Pretty interesting, the contrast. And, of course, whether you're a fan of either or somewhere in between, I think one thing that we can certainly comment on, and just stepping back and looking at not just the presidency, but the nation of America, and just how much television has changed the United States, and even things like elections. And I think it was, who was it? It was from 1960. Paul Johnson, the one who wrote about the history of the history of America, his long work on that. I forget the exact title, but he talked about in those debates from 1960 between Nixon and JFK how that, in his view and in the view of quite a few at the time, that one of the big reasons that Nixon lost was because of television. For those that just listened to the debates on radio, it was clear that Nixon would come out the winner each time. But then the ones watching it on television, and television at that time was still a fairly new medium, but those watching it on TV saw in JFK, of course, a more charismatic, nicer-looking individual. And they saw in Nixon someone who was older and who was wiping the sweat off of his forehead. And that factored in. I can remember, I couldn't find it before I came down here, but I can remember, I think it was from the 1950s, maybe 1955, where Mr. Armstrong, and of course, you know, if you know anything about the ministry of Herbert Armstrong, you know how that he used these mediums, radio and television in particular. But he did send out one coworker letter, I think in the mid-1950s, where he talked about everyone getting swept up into the television craze and how that it was becoming an idol for so many people. Coworkers, even, that were interested in the church, that were reading or studying some of the material that the church had distributed, but that by the time that the minister came around to visit them and to see where they were spiritually, so many of them had lost interest between the time that they requested for a ministerial visit and then the time that visit actually happened. So many of them, as he said, were just getting caught up into the cares of this world and watching hours and hours of television each day and not studying the Bible. No matter what kind of coverage you're going to get about presidential habits today, depending upon if he's a Republican or a Democrat, one thing is for sure, I mean, we're living in a very different time than even just a few generations ago, 2, 3, 4 generations ago. In Isaiah 3, if you look at the prophecy for our day, and the dearth of leadership, those first few verses. And then I think it's verses 5 and 6 that talk about, you know, no one really wanting to rule because the curses that set in. And then, of course, later on in the chapter talks about the family being upside down, and there's no mention of the father or the husband. Those are the days that we're living through, and you certainly do see it in the behavior of so many of our leaders. Well, switching over now to this breaking news from Friday night about the ongoing Brexit negotiations. This from the American Spectator. It says the result, it's talking about the Brexit vote from 2016, how that it won 52-48%, those in favor of leaving, that is. And that caused David Cameron's resignation, just to give you some, just a summary of some of the more recent history following Brexit. And it opened the way for Theresa May to become prime minister. She's been prime minister now for a year and a half. And, I mean, her main objective is to come up with some kind of a favorable deal on the Brexit negotiations. And this article from American Spectator, it says, the French, who with the Germans are the two strongest powers in the EU, immediately placed ridiculous demands on the British, all the while saying that the Brits could ignore the referendum and just stay in the EU. That's what they wanted. Just disregard the referendum and stay in. That's what some of us have done on the continent. Among their demands were continued British financial support for the EU budget and EU bureaucrats' pensions, and continued obedience to EU courts' decisions, laws, and regulations. In short, Britain would surrender its vote in EU decisions, but would regain its sovereignty. Mrs. May and her cabinet have made it easier for the EU to make the Brexit negotiations much harder, though May kept saying Brexit means Brexit, implying a hard deal would be negotiated. She refrained from giving anyone any specific ideas of what her goals were. And well, now we're beginning to see some of the details as they come forward, and it's not good. As the Spectator says here, really, it's lousy. It's a lousy deal for the UK. Before the deal could be made, Arlene Foster, it says, leader of the Northern Ireland DUP, wouldn't agree without preserving the uncontrolled border between the Irish Republic to the south. An uncontrolled border meant that people and goods could flow without restriction, essentially leaving Northern Ireland in the EU. So that's one of the sticking points here. If you go over to Ireland, the Republic, you can drive from Dublin up to Belfast, and there's no customs. There's no security checks at the border. So with Britain on the way out, Northern Ireland, of course, part of Britain, what do you do? What do you do with that border? Well, the leaders in Northern Ireland, they don't want a customs or a border agent to be there between Northern Ireland and the Republic. It says May scrambled to deal with Foster's demand, leading to a last-minute amendment to an agreement which provides that, and then it gives some of the bullet points of these terms. The UK will pay its original share of the EU budget in 2019 and 20, as well as an undefined contribution to the pensions of bureaucrats, an amount that is around $50 to $60 billion, or I guess it would be euros or pounds. It says EU citizens can claim permanent residency in the UK with their future rights determined by EU courts. And then it says Northern Ireland will continue in full alignment with EU laws and regulations to maintain the all-island economy provided by the 1998 Good Friday Agreement that ended the Troubles, the period of Irish terrorism and unrest that continued for decades. So as the Spectator brings out, I mean, this deal essentially leaves Northern Ireland within the EU. That's a separate island from England and Scotland and Wales. So this deal, it leaves them basically in the EU. I mean, it further fractures the already divisive nature between England and Northern Ireland. I think this, it's from this article. It quotes the tweet that Nigel Farage sent out following this this tentative agreement that was in place Friday night. Farage said a deal in Brussels is good news for Mrs. May, as we can now move on to the next stage of humiliation. So it's quick wit, as always. But there's Farage commenting on this lousy deal. The Telegraph said Theresa May is gambling that she can get a good trade deal with the EU, but she can't. That's from the Telegraph. And then another piece in the same paper says this Brexit deal is no breakthrough. It's a complete capitulation. It's a complete surrender to the EU. Another one from the Telegraph says Tory Brexiteers are privately furious about Theresa May's deal, quote unquote, with the EU. And it's talking about how there could be a leadership challenge as a result of this. I think it might be in this same article how that some of the contenders, like Boris Johnson, they're happy. They're happy right now to just kind of be on the sidelines and to let Theresa May go down. Let her be responsible for this capitulation. And then, of course, you have Jeremy Corbyn's party waiting in the wings as well. And they're ready, as another article I saw this morning brings out, they're ready for some radical changes. As soon as they might gain power, they're ready for it. And there's quite a few in Britain that are very supportive of the radical leftist Marxist party that is Jeremy Corbyn's. Well, that's here in the UK, in Europe, in Germany in particular. This article that compares Germany today with the Weimar Republic. It says here, for all the institutional, this is from the New York Review of Books, December 11th, that would be today. It says, for all the institutional safeguards in Germany's post-war system, which were designed to prevent extremist parties from gaining seats in parliament, the September election results bear a distinct resemblance to the results of the September 1930 election for the Reichstag. Naturally, the ideologies of the parties of left and right in 2017 are different from those that contended in 1930, but the logic of the political divisions in the two legislatures is nevertheless similar. This can hardly be encouraging, either for the stability of any government or for the long-term health of Germany's political culture. And then further on, I mean, just listen to some of these similarities, because we're seeing this play out again. And again, some of the parties, some of the ideologies might be a little bit different, but history's repeating itself. That's what this and other articles like this are bringing out. I mean, this is the real news. And that's another sad component to that feature in the New York Times yesterday. 4,300 words on how much Diet Coke and how much Fox News he's watching or Coke that he's drinking. And here this is happening. The 1930 election signaled the end of government by parliamentary majority in the Weimar Republic. Most dramatically, the Nazi Party's parliamentary delegation expanded from a mere 12 seats after the 1928 elections to 107 in 1930. So over the course of 2 years, the Nazi Party went from 12 seats to 107 in just a 24-month period. And of course, 107 seats in 1930, that amounted to about one-fifth of the Reichstag. Not a majority, but certainly moving in that direction. That same year, the communists won 77 seats. This review here says, both of these parties were set up, were set on subverting parliamentary government, and no coalition could be built by the more moderate parties. The chancellor, Heinrich Brüning, of the Catholic Center Party, managed to keep the government running only because the Social Democrats agreed to tolerate him. That is, they refrained from casting negative votes that would have placed him in an outright minority and would have forced new elections with perhaps even worse outcomes. Does that sound familiar? Well, that's why they're afraid to call for new elections today, for fear of what it might produce. It could be even worse. If Chancellor Merkel chose to attempt a minority government now, for it to function, would require similar toleration by the Social Democrats, although such a government could not be toppled by negative votes alone. The resulting paralysis could force new elections. And then it switches back to that history in the early 1930s. It says here, by the summer of 1932, the aging president, Paul von Hindenburg, was persuaded to replace Bruning with the reactionary aristocrat Franz von Papen, who promised to secure a workable conservative majority. Instead, in July elections, the Nazis won 230 seats. So another 2 years, and now it's pushing for about half of the Reichstag. Or it says here, I guess about a third at that time. The communists pulled in 89. It says, together the hard right and the hard left constituted a majority of the Reichstag, but they were dedicated to opposing each other and any other possible combination of parties. The Weimar Republic descended into the final year of its existence, shorn of any parliamentary legitimacy. Another Reichstag election in November 1932, in which the National Socialist vote actually receded, gave hope that the party might break into factions or lose its appeal. But on January 30th, the right-wing coalition convinced President Hindenburg to appoint as chancellor Adolf Hitler, who would supposedly be restrained by conservatives in his cabinet. Hitler called new elections for March 1933, in which the Nazis won nearly 44% of the votes, and he soon passed an enabling act that authorized 5 years of dictatorial rule. In the long crisis of the Weimar Republic, the Nazis' electoral breakthrough in 1930 and the parliamentary paralysis it created led directly to the power collapse of German democracy. This is from the New York Times, the New York Review of Books. I'm not sure if that's connected with the New York Times or not. In any event, the last part of this article says, looking past the specific ideologies of the parties involved, consider the divisions of the two legislatures of 1930 and 2017. And then it goes on to give all of these graphs and pie charts and so on. It's a pretty it's an in-depth article, an in-depth look at this comparison, the echoes of Weimar, as it refers to this crisis in Germany today. Well, there's a couple of other pieces. I can probably just paraphrase these quickly, but one from Spiegel, both of them actually from Spiegel, about how that President Trump's decision last week to to recognize Jerusalem is only going to make peace more difficult. And you have these commentators and even prominent German politicians who are calling for Germany and Europe to take the lead when it comes to the so-called peace process. We had a lot to say about that last week, you might remember, if you listened in. But here is Germany now saying, well, if that's Trump's position, if this is the direction the Trump administration is headed, then we need to take charge. We need to take the lead. And, of course, that fits right in with what your Bible prophesies as well. Judah, little Judah, eventually going to the Assyrians because of the wound. And as we covered last week, I mean, in the short term, it is going to get worse in Jerusalem and in Israel. Not for the reasons that so many were saying last Friday, Thursday, and the day before when the decision was made to recognize Jerusalem, but still, it's going to be a burdensome stone, as Zechariah says. But here comes Germany now becoming more assertive because of this. And then another one, they're both from Spiegel, on Donald Trump's new tax plan and how it worries Europe, and how that this tax reform that could be passed by the end of this year, it's really the beginning of a new tax race And this, I thought, tied right in with what we've been saying in recent months about the prophesied trade war. Because if the Trump administration gives all these tax breaks now to corporations and such and just makes it more favorable for them to be situated in the United States, how are other nations going to react to this? And will they band together? We know that they will. We've gone through some of these prophecies before, how that there's going to be a trade alliance that ends up shutting out the United States and shutting out Great Britain. As for the King of the South, that factors in, of course, to multiple prophecies. Speaking of the New York Times, I guess that's the theme for the day. They printed an op-ed, yesterday? Yes, yesterday, by Mohammad Javid Zarif. He's the Iranian foreign minister, who's basically saying now that Trump has done this, this, and this, he's directing his commentary, which is printed in the New York Times. He's directing his commentary at Europe, saying that, you know, you in Europe, you nations of Europe, you shouldn't side with the U.S. Don't side with Donald Trump. Look at what he's doing to the peace process. Look at what he's done with Jerusalem. Look at how unreliable he is as an ally. He even brings up climate change. This is the Iranian foreign minister. And the New York Times, together with him, happily printing anything and everything he has to say, happily printing what the Iranian foreign minister has to say about the Iran nuke deal, how that this has been a smashing success. And that the only reason that Iran has been a little bit aggressive, like in Yemen, is because of Saudi Arabia. It's Saudi Arabia who's the aggressor there. It's amazing. It's amazing how quick the New York Times is to print these kinds of op-eds that just fly right in the face of just U.S. foreign policy, for one. But that's the United States today. Everything's political. Everything. Every single thing. Meanwhile, there's another piece from the Washington Post, and this just echoes what others have been saying the last few weeks. Now that ISIS is no longer a threat, guess who the real problem is now in Iraq, now that ISIS is gone? Yes, indeed, Iran is emerging. And this Washington Post piece talks about how, it, I guess, quotes an American diplomat saying that the United States now needs to counter Iran and roll back Iran's influence. This is according to U.S. Ambassador Douglas Suleiman. He took up his post in Baghdad in September 2016, according to this article. But he's quoted in the article as saying Iran simply does not respect the sovereignty of its neighbors. They don't respect the sovereignty of Iraq. They're not going to leave, as we've covered on previous programs. Just because the U.S. wants them to leave or wants them to go home doesn't mean that they will. In fact, the Iraqi officials want them to stay. This too. It falls right in line with what we've said based on prophecies, numerous prophecies. It falls right in line, Psalm 83, Daniel 11. It falls right in line with what we've been saying at the trumpet for over 20 years, that Iran would eventually take over Iraq there in the Middle East. Well, I've got a couple of other pieces here, but I'll just conclude with that since we're already a little bit long on this segment. When we come back, we'll look more closely at the first commandment and what it means to revolve your life around the great Creator God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Come on.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Back in 2010, NASA launched its Solar Dynamics Observatory. And this satellite was launched basically to study more into our sun. And according to this this book I got a few months ago, 15 million degrees, it's about the sun by Professor Lucy Green. But she says in her book that this this one satellite collects more data in a week about our sun than the Hubble Space Telescope generates in a year for the rest of the universe. So they're collecting a lot of data, a lot of information about this dominant star in our solar system. And it is dominant. The Solar Dynamics Observatory, this is in Professor Green's book, it has literally expanded our horizons and even shown that the atmosphere of the sun reaches out to a staggering 18 billion kilometers beyond us. That's 120 times further out than the Earth's orbit. And she says here, we are living in the sun's atmosphere. So here is this massive, dominant star, and it literally gives life to planet Earth. In her book, she says, not only does sunlight allow us to see, but it made our rocky planet habitable for millions of species of animals and plants. It grows our food, it drives our weather, and it can even be utilized to generate electricity to power modern society. Sunlight is amazingly versatile, but above all, there is something about sunlight that means it is able to keep us alive. We literally could not live without it. We couldn't live without the sun. Everything about our physical lives, everything about our planet, revolves around the sun. Now, let me just take you through a couple of Psalms, well, and hopefully a few other passages as well, because there's a valuable spiritual lesson in this for us as well. Psalm chapter 19, this is where David introduces the passage or the psalm by saying, "The heavens declare the glory of God." I mean, if David would say this 3,000 years ago, what would he say today with all of our modern technology, with the Hubble Space Telescope or the Solar Dynamics Observatory, this satellite that's collecting all of this data about our sun. The heavens declare the glory of God. I mean, there's a message from God in the heavens. They declare something about God, his glorious power, and even about the order of creation. They declare something even about the first commandment. Verse 2 says, day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, verse 3, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. So here is this vast creation, this universe that God brought into existence, and it's declaring a message from God. It's speaking in that sense. Not necessarily in a spoken way, literally, but there is a message. And it's coming through loud and clear. If we have eyes to see, if we open up our eyes and look, as I say, look at all of the images and the information coming back from the Hubble telescope and from these modern scientific instruments like that Solar Dynamics Observatory. The heavens declare the glory of God. They certainly do. Verse 4 says, their line, this is from Psalm 19, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. It says, in them, that's speaking of the heavens, in them has God set a tabernacle for the sun. So you read this right in the Psalms. This is 3,000 years old. And look at it, it's just spot on. David knew that our solar system revolves around the sun. King David knew that. God revealed that to him. He knew that the sun dominates our solar system in every respect. Now, as I say, there's a valuable spiritual lesson that you can take away from this, particularly if you understand from Malachi 4 that Jesus Christ is a type, or rather that the sun is a type of Christ. Christ is called in Malachi 4 the Son of Righteousness. That's Son with a U, S-U-N, capital S-U-N, Son of Righteousness. And, of course, you can flip over to the New Testament and see all of these passages, John 1, John 3, and others, about spiritual light, about the light that Jesus Christ brought into this dark world, spiritual light. And so he's the Son. And as Joel Hilliker brings out in our universe booklet, our lives should revolve around God in the same way that our planet does the sun. The sun, as I mentioned, giving you a couple of quotes from that book, I mean, it fills this earth. We literally could not live without it. It affects everything. We're living in the sun's atmosphere. And so, as is brought out in the Universe booklet, our lives, when you look at this spiritually, our lives should revolve around God in the same way that the planet does the sun. It continues here in the Psalm, verse 5, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. Again, it's talking about the sun and how strong it is, the power that's there, the strength of the sun. David comparing it to this powerful athlete, this strong man. And in the Universe booklet, Joel Hilliker also notes that every single second, the sun produces the same amount of energy as a trillion nuclear bombs. How about that for power and might? Every single second, in just 1 second, he says, the sun produces more energy than the entire human race has consumed in its 6,000-year history. Just 1 second. In her book, 15 Million Degrees, Professor Green, she says that the sun does not explode like a thermonuclear bomb is because of a delicate balancing act This is coming from an evolutionist, I believe. She talks about a delicate balancing act, one that keeps the sun exploding enough to stay hot, but not so much that it blows apart. We now know this equilibrium was established when the sun was young and that fusion proceeded at a steady rate and has remained safely stable ever since. So she just takes for granted then that there's all these laws in place that guarantee this stability, this delicate balancing act, this equilibrium, to use her words. Going back to verse 4 in this psalm, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them has God set a tabernacle for the sun. So God has set and established all of these laws of physics that keep everything just so in the universe. You can look at the Hebrew word there for line, and it has to do with the measuring cord or a ruler. God stretched the line. God stretched the measuring stick. He stretched it upon the earth to measure it. There's rules or there's laws that guarantee the delicate balancing act, or the steady rate, or the equilibrium, or the stability. And of course, there's a great spiritual reality in this as well. Verse 6 says, His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Here again, just to emphasize the dominance of this star inside of our solar system. What is it? I think you could, this is in the universe booklet, but I think you can fit 1 million Earths inside of the sun. Just to give you some sense of the size we're talking about, as well as the strength. But then it goes on to say in verse 7, the law of the eternal is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the eternal is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the eternal is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the eternal are true and righteous altogether. All of this harmony that comes from God's spiritual laws. And in the booklet, the universe booklet, Mr. Hilliker brings out how that there's some commentaries that say that, well, verse 7 begins another subject because it starts talking about God's laws. But as he says in the booklet, it's not a new subject. It's the same great creator God who brought all of the universe into existence and has definite laws established to keep the equilibrium, the delicate balancing act, and so on. And in the same way, we can bring order and harmony into our lives, our individual lives, so long as we submit to God's laws, so long as we submit to God's authority. We'll find that same delicate balance. We'll find that same spiritual equilibrium. We'll find that same stability. And so when you look at this subject, when you let the message come through from the heavens, there's a message being declared after all. What does it mean with respect to our spiritual lives? And in particular, with respect to obedience to the first and great commandment. Moses said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord," or one eternal, "and you shall love the eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart." That's from Deuteronomy 6. God is our life. Spiritually speaking, we literally can't live without him. We can't. We are living in his atmosphere. He is the dominant star in our solar system, spiritually speaking. That's how big he needs to be. As big as the sun is in our solar system. Putting God first above all else. That's what this means. Of course, in Exodus 20, the first and great commandment is spelled out. God there saying to Israel, look, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of this house of bondage. And then he says in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me, no one else, no other person, no other thing, nothing is to come before me or be in place of me. God has to fit that top position. He's the dominant star in the galaxy, in the solar system. Our lives revolve around him. Jesus said, seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Seek after the spiritual first. And then in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is quoted as saying, and it's very similar to what you read in Deuteronomy 6, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Going back to the plain truth, this is from February 1960, it asks this regarding the first commandment, have you put something else in place of God? Is your time, your interest, your service taken up more with something other than the true God? What idol have you placed between yourself and the true God, studying his word and living by it? That's the point Mr. Armstrong was getting at back in the 1950s when he wrote co-workers and said, look, I'm concerned that some of you are letting something like television come between you and God. I'm concerned that some of you are letting television come between you and the kingdom of God, because you're no longer digging into your Bibles like you once did. Let me just conclude with a few verses from another psalm. This is Psalm 63. It's a great psalm with respect to this first commandment. You want to learn more about putting God first? Read the first, I think, 8 verses of this beautiful psalm, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. He was out in some remote location without television, without distractions, without so many of the things that today consume our lives and our time. David says here in Psalm 63, verse 1, O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. I am so hungry and thirsty for you and your way of life. I can't live without you. I revolve around you. I exist in your atmosphere. You dominate my life. Verse 2 says, to see your power and your glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips shall praise you. Thus will I bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. That's verse 4. And then David says, My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. He just couldn't sing praises enough. Praises to God, prayers and thanksgiving. David said in verse 6, when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the night watches, if he was awake at night, or if he suddenly awakened in the middle of the night, he would then concentrate on the things of God. It wouldn't be worldly things. It wouldn't be evil things. He set his mind on the things above, like Paul said in Colossians 3. He sought after the kingdom of God. Verse 8 says, because you have been my help, therefore in the shadow of your wings will I rejoice. My soul, it says in verse 8, my soul follows hard after you. Your right hand upholds me. If you look at the Hebrew words there, follow hard, it's the same Hebrew word translated as cleave in Genesis 2 and Deuteronomy 10, where it talks about cleaving to a spouse or a husband. That's the idea here in the first commandment. Cleaving to God, revolving around God, orbiting God, living in the atmosphere of God. God always, always, yeah, he has first place. He's right in the center. And there we are, revolving around him in every respect. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.